Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi guys, Barnaby here. Hope you've all been well in 2021 so far and have been dealing with the pandemic as best as possible. I've started a new podcast series called Crazy Stupid Love, in which I talk to guests about issues in their relationships, love, and sex lives. In the first episode, I interview someone who I've spoken about a lot in Almost Famous, but has never come on. My own mother, Stephanie DeSykes. The reason I wanted to speak to her at the start of Crazy Stupid Love is to try and work out for myself why I've always had such a fascination with matters of the heart and have consistently loved hearing about people's relationship issues throughout my life. In the episode, we discuss how my own observations of her relationships with men helped forge my fascination with how people interact with each other when it comes to love, and also talk about the most difficult moment in her life and a very formative part of mine when she was raped in her early 50s. By someone who just happened to be a famous sportsman, and I ask her why she's never felt willing to name the person who did it in public. The episode is coming up after this message, and I would love it if you'd give it a listen. My mum Stephanie is the main reason why the podcast Almost Famous exists, and there are many extremely relevant elements in the interview to the Almost Famous podcast. I'm really proud of this new series and think it's some of my best work, so if you like what you hear, please, please do subscribe or follow Crazy Stupid Love. The link to where to find the podcast is in the description box, or just type Crazy Stupid Love into the search wherever you listen to your podcasts. There are loads of amazing episodes coming up, with my guests discussing incredible dating and relationship moments that they've found themselves in, from dating an incel to the most extreme ghosting you've ever heard of, grooming, and even someone who was very happily dating a man until he suddenly told her that if she didn't, in his words, shit on his dick, it would be all over. So, as I said, please do listen to episode 1 with Stephanie here once I finish talking, but also it would be so fantastic if you'd subscribe to the podcast Crazy Stupid Love 2 and check out the other episodes. There are 3 available with the launch, then they'll be coming out every single week. Thanks so much and hope you enjoy this first episode of Crazy Stupid Love with my very first guest, Stephanie DeSykes. Welcome to Crazy Stupid Love with me, Barnaby Slater. In this new podcast series, I'm inviting guests onto the show and asking them to come armed with something they'd like to discuss to do with their relationship, love, or sex lives, and then quite simply, we talk about it. But for the first episode, I wanted to get an understanding myself of why I've always loved talking to people about their relationships, and even at times felt able to offer my opinions on what is happening in friends' and families' love lives, despite the fact that, well, to be honest, I haven't always been that successful when it comes to matters of the heart myself. The main reason I've always thought that I'm fascinated by this subject is because of my relationship with my guest today, the amazing, incredible Stephanie DeSykes, who just so happens to be my mother. Welcome to the show, Mum. How are you?
Hello, my son. I'm good.
So we're in your conservatory. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of flowers about, and we're pretty much keeping to the rules of the pandemic lockdown. We're towards the back end. I'm about to get my jab. That's yes. How we are. That's where we're at.
I think we'll be all right.
I think we're going to be fine.
Certainly you didn't give me a kiss or a hug when I picked you up at the station.
That's what all of my guests say. That's the first thing they always say. Now, as I kind of mentioned in the intro, I've always thought that I've been drawn to people, to talking to people about relationships because of the time that you and I spent together when my brother moved out.
Yes.
Which is when I was about kind of between 14, 15 and 18, and we lived alone together. And by my recollection, I was kind of going through peak adolescence, puberty stuff. And I think you were going through the menopause, although that maybe that's something I've made up myself.
No, you're spot on. You're spot on.
And I've always kind of come up with this narrative that that kind of period, although it was often difficult, also bonded us closer together.
Absolutely right.
And then I also have in my head this kind of towards the back end of that time, or maybe certainly in my early 20s, that kind of thing happening where your relationship as a child swaps round with your parents. So you started coming to me about matters of love and sex, less sex, but kind of relationships and your love life, and telling me a bit more about that. So do you think that's kind of a fair enough description of how you remember it?
I think your memory is probably sharper than mine, but I think you pretty much nailed it, yes.
Okay, and so, you know, I've spoken on some of my other podcast stuff about my relationship with my father and my stepfather, and I wanted to ask you, having brought up two boys, or bringing up two boys, but having had history with their father figures of trust issues and relationship adultery issues as well, how did that make it? Did that make it more difficult for you raising two boys, or how did you feel you had to act with your sons in a way, I guess, to try and make sure they didn't follow a similar path?
Well, it's what an intelligent question. I'm really
Why
shocked.
Do you sound so surprised?
Yes, of course I was aware of it. On the other hand, I was aware of the danger of brainwashing you. I didn't want to do that either. But I was, to give you both your due, I was aware of the fact that you two gradually, you started making comments which indicated that you, it wasn't a, that wasn't a course that you wished to follow in your lives. Mm. I therefore assumed that you'd probably both get married very young and stay with the same wife forever. And I couldn't have been more wrong, because neither of you is married. And you've dealt with it in a different way. But I don't think, from my knowledge, that either of you has become a serial shagger, a liar, cheat. Mm. You know, that's... was always, I think that you did know that the important thing was, I said to you both, and I did brainwash you in this regard, was the importance of honesty. And I've sort of beaten myself up over that in more recent years, because I feel that maybe I imposed my obsession upon you guys, which I perhaps, given that time again, I would have tried to avoid doing.
And where does your obsession with honesty come from?
I don't know. I really don't know. It just seemed so simple.
You told a story to me when I was pretty young, and I think you've told it a few times, about how your father, my grandfather, would refuse to find himself alone in a room with a woman who wasn't his wife.
Well, it wasn't quite like that. No, I know that where he worked, they had a canteen, and he would get his food and he'd take his tray. And if the only space available was on a table with a single woman sitting on it, he wouldn't go there.
Because he'd be tempted, or because it might look like he was flirting, or?
Or maybe afraid that he was giving the wrong idea.
I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, he was a strange man, but he was a faithful husband. And I think very often, although he had many faults that I wouldn't have wanted a partner of mine to emulate, in that regard, it was something that I wanted and expected. But I never asked a partner to be faithful. I asked them to be honest. And I think you knew that. You probably heard me shouting that. In an argument.
You've used the word brainwash. I think brainwash is an unfair term. I don't feel I've ever been brainwashed. You did have some rules. I remember some rules. You know, don't ride a motorcycle, don't take drugs. A thing that came up in a podcast I did before with a broadcast called Emily Dean, who also grew up with a quite a similar upbringing in that her parents were both kind of liberal creatives.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she felt she was adulted very early, which I then asked what did she feel that meant. And she said basically that the kind of liberal conversations that her parents would have in front of her when she was very young really kind of seeped through without her realizing. And so when you talk, you know, you've talked about the rules and brainwashing, but and talking about the need for us to be honest, but have you ever thought about the reality of, you know, what was it possible that you were having those arguments in front of us too much or too early, and we would have picked up things by osmosis without realizing that has affected our ability to have relationships or deal with these kind of things?
Oh, well, quite possibly. I mean, I don't recall sort of having lots of arguments there in the same room as you, but of course, I know your brother was very good at eavesdropping. Yes, and of course, voices were raised, of course, yes. Mm.
But also maybe not just, I mean, I don't feel strongly that this is what happened, but I do know that, you know, I have recollections of probably hearing conversations between you and friends, or you and, you know, maybe at parties we had or something.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Where I didn't understand what was going on. I'm sure my brother Toby is very intelligent. But, and maybe he explained to me, I don't remember.
Quite possibly.
But that's kind of something that comes with potentially a more liberal upbringing, where you're kind of
more open.
You're given access to more adult stuff than maybe more of a disciplined parenthood would give you. So,
well,
it has
yes.
its pros, but possibly also has some cons too.
Of course, it does.
I wouldn't change a thing, by the way. I'm not suggesting I would. Well, I'm just intrigued by all this.
Bless you for saying that. The rule about being honest doesn't mean you have to just spill your guts all the time. You know, there are things that you can avoid telling somebody, which I've clearly done. I think we're going to talk about that later. Mm. I wasn't going to deliberately lumber you with information that you weren't ready to hear. But that's not dishonest, and trying to get your timing right, I think. Mm. But with children, you have to be very careful.
The other thing that you talking about Grandpa made me think is then, and then you actually saying, or you didn't ask either, you didn't ask, you know, my father or my stepfather to be faithful, you just asked them to be honest. My instinct right then is, of course, if a woman were to say that to me, I'm not even suggesting that necessarily you said to them, I doubt you ever said to them, I'm not asking you to be faithful, certainly not at the start, I'm not asking you to be faithful, I'm asking you to be honest. But if I did ever hear that as a man, straight away I'd be thinking, what you're asking me to be is faithful, but you're saying it in a different way.
Well, yes, of course. Yeah. Whatever, my view was, if it's all right to do it, then it's all right to talk about it.
Mm.
But doing it and pretending you're not doing it, well, where's the justification in that? That's to protect oneself. What about the other person who is 50% of the setup, the relationship?
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's what always astonished me, that, you know, I'd be told, what, I remember your father saying to me once, why couldn't you be like the other wives where I work and just avert your gaze?
Mm.
I said, well, but if it's all right to do it, why wasn't it all right to tell me about it? Well, look how you react. Well, yes.
Does he mean by that, you know, were you digging in to find out what he was up to? Do you mean, or is he just saying he would tell you, but then he wants you to bring it up?
No, of course he never told me. He lied through his teeth. That's what he was best at, unfortunately.
Not that good at it if you kept finding out.
Well, no, all right. It came most naturally to him, but no, he wasn't terribly good at it.
Right. And then the other thing I was thinking was, you know, so you grew up with a father who was very faithful and single-minded in terms of making, like we talked about the canteen story, and obviously very opinionated and judgmental on things of that ilk.
Mm.
But how do you think that affected you then, and you as a woman going into finding a man or men, having grown up with this father figure who was so straight down the line on that front, and then finding out that in your experience, you know, from your experience, not all men were like that.
Well, and a lot of women also.
Sure,
you know.
Of course.
And you're very observant, and it did affect me. Of course it did, but I mean,
do you think you went into relationships naively, thinking that it would be like your father was?
No. I was slightly wiser than that, but I just thought that if in a relationship we could have an arrangement whereby we had honesty, then the rest of the stuff could be dealt with as it came along, if it had to be dealt with. But in the meantime, would probably prevent a lot of problems arising in the first place. That was naive, I think.
Okay. So if, for instance, then my dad, instead of, shagging everything that moved, probably giving him some credit there, if anything, because I'm sure some people said no to Stuart. Love him as I do. But if he'd come to you and said, oh, I'm attracted to this woman at work, I'd quite like to sleep with her, before he did it, how do you think you would genuinely actually have reacted to that? Because it's all well and good, I think, saying in hindsight, I just wish you'd have been honest about it. But in reality, surely that would have broken your heart and made, you wouldn't have said to him, go for it. Thank you for being honest. Let's see what happens afterwards.
Funnily enough, many years later, that very thing did happen to me quite early on in a relationship, a new relationship. It was about, 12 years ago, so it wasn't, mm-hmm. It was the last real relationship that I had. And he said that very thing. And I was so shocked because, as I say, it was so early in the relationship, and he seemed so delighted that we were an item. I was completely shocked, and I did say, well, okay, we'll have an open relationship then. I mean, I just didn't know what else to say. We were in a public place for a start. I wasn't going to stamp about. And in any event, it was too early in the relationship for me to make demands. Mm. So I just thought this would be the intelligent thing to say. And then he was actually going away. Mm. So it was that he might find himself in a situation while he was away, rather than the fact that he'd met somebody. And his reaction was complete shock when I said, we'll have an open relationship.
Because he was happy to have an open relationship on his end, but didn't want it to be on yours.
Vividly, he looked at me aghast and said, well, that wouldn't work. And I said, well, why not? And then he stood up and he stormed out of the pub we were in and didn't speak to me for days.
Do you think that, is it possible that he did that, as in told you in advance, because you may have spoken about your previous relationships and said, all I ever asked for was honesty, and they were never honest with me until they were, until they'd been found out?
Quite possibly, because we'd known each other a long time.
Right.
We'd been friends for many years, so we'd sort of crossed the line. And, I suppose I felt it was the only answer that I could give. And because he was going away, it meant that I had a couple of weeks to think about it and decide how I wanted to handle this situation.
But also presumably a couple of weeks of being upset and wondering what he was up to.
Yes, but I just needed to buy myself some time at that, because I was so shocked.
Right.
So I don't know. Do we always know what we will do as a result of something we've said? I don't think we do. Mm. Sometimes we come up with the best thing that springs to mind at the time. And I think that was one of those. So if your father had said it to me, I think it would have depended on whether it was before or after I had children.
Mm.
I think once you have children, the rules have to be pretty...
But he'd been unfaithful to you before you had...
Oh, yeah, we'd split up and all sorts of nonsense.
Right. I'm not trying to... Not in any way... I think the reason why I think this is worth talking about is because I think it's incredibly relatable to people, whether they've had children or not, to be in situations like this. But I think what you don't hear about a lot, or the stories you don't hear a lot about, are the people who've been through all of that, had children, come out the other side and have like a hindsight view on it. In my experience, and this is what this podcast is about, when I talk to people or when I talk to my friends, and they're in these situations that we've all been in, where you're with someone and it's, you've split up, and then you think, oh, should we get back together? And maybe you do it over and over and over.
Mm.
And everyone tells you, oh, you have to not do it. But sometimes you know, drawn back to people. Well, there's just reality.
There's an awful lot of needing to win as well involved in all that, which...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I've got a girlfriend who has a partner, a husband, who really she should have got rid of years ago. He treated her absolutely appallingly, and he ended up with another woman, and she took him back, and now she's basically looking after him because he's not very well. And I said, why on earth did you... You know, he behaved so appallingly. And she said, I had to win. She said, I had to beat that other woman. Right. I said, yeah, but she was getting the rough end of the deal. She was going to get him. I mean, the man's an arsehole. Mm. He's stolen money from her and all sorts of things. No, she had to win. And there's an awful lot of that in relationships as well.
Yeah.
Got to win.
Power games.
Yeah.
I mean, but that example sounds, and a lot of these are, but it sounds like codependency as well. And it might be easier for her to say, oh, I had to win, even though that is a great... What comes across to me is a great kind of rare line of honesty from someone. It doesn't sound like something that someone would openly admit that often. But also, it might be slightly easier for her to say that to you than to say, I need him, I can't live without him, when you know he's done all this stuff.
And also, she could live a lot better without him because he's so damn needy and difficult. But so basically, hers was a Pyrrhic victory, you know.
Yeah.
But very often, we're that's what people do. They'd rather have a Pyrrhic victory and end up with the thing that is worse for them than actually have that strength to walk away. That's the difficult one.
I was going to ask, you know, what would you change about your relationships? But then it got me thinking really quickly about the kind of interesting kind of difficulty of looking back probably on your relationships, what I'd call your main two relationships, or certainly the two that affected my life. So my father and then my stepfather, with whom you were with for 9 years. Is that right?
Overall? That's right. Yeah.
Right. So particularly when it comes, I guess, to with my dad, I wonder, how do you feel now looking back in terms of things you would change, but also when, you know, yes, he treated you badly continuously, but also you had the children with him, with which you're most, you know, I'm not bigging myself up, but it's the thing that makes you happiest in your life and most proud.
My
and stuff
biggest
like
achievement,
that.
Yes. Right.
So how does that kind of manifest itself in terms of your thought processes, looking back on your life and thinking, you know, things you would have changed or could have done differently to make you happier now?
Were it not for you boys, what I would have changed would be that I would not have got involved with your father in the first place. But...
You hated him when you first met him anyway, right?
Funnily enough, yes, I did. But the truth is that I was incredibly broody. And here's another problem.
What age was that then?
Well, late 20s. Mm. And the broodiness was just getting... And in those days, that was late not to have had children. I mean, I gave birth to your brother when I was 31. And there was something on my notes in the hospital. I don't know if I've got the wording right. It was something like elderly prima gravida or something.
Right.
And I think I invented your father, really. I mean, he had great qualities as well. And we had the music that we could write together,
yeah.
Which was
so
very
important.
So
for anyone who doesn't... I mean, let's assume that nobody has listened to any of the other podcasts I've done. My parents were both musicians and they met as a result of working at the same record company.
Yeah.
Right.
Really? I should have known better, and I did know better.
Talk to me about what you mean when you say you invented him.
Well, I believed that he had qualities that only I could expose and reveal, and it's pathetic.
I think that's quite common.
Well,
I think that's quite
is.
A common feeling where people, if they're telling you about their relationship issues, and they won't be as honest as you've just been, I think. But what they feel is only they are capable of seeing the real person.
Yes. I think it's classic stuff.
Mm.
Yes, I call it invention. I mean, I don't want
can you
to...
Can you give any examples of what that meant on a day-to-day basis? I mean, other than, I guess, the adultery that we've talked about.
Well, he'd been married before. He had a daughter, of course, your sister. And... He could have been a better father, clearly, and I therefore should not have chosen him to have my babies with. But I was so broody that I would almost have sort of, you know, chosen anybody. Isn't that dreadful?
No, it's incredibly honest. And I certainly know of, you know, friends of mine, people in my friendship circle, where I look at them and think, I think there's an element of that potentially, where it gets to a certain point.
Listen, Mother Nature is a very powerful force. She's not interested in our hearts. She's interested in the procreation of the various species, and we're one of them. And that's all that matters, really.
And you said a fascinating thing there about having seen how my dad treated his daughter, my sister Tracy, when you met him. So how did you weigh up, how did you justify not being overly impressed with that, with them getting together with this person? Because you always, from what I've heard, and the way she talks about you and the way you talk about my sister, even though she wasn't yours, treated her incredibly well from the first time you met her. So I wonder whether you were like, well, I can bring more to her as a parent with him, and that might help me justify being with him and then maybe even having children with him myself. By kind of maybe like making him a better father, making it more of a family unit.
Yeah, teaching him how to do it. You know, I would say, have you phoned your daughter yet? You know, have you done that today? Have you done that this week or whatever? I just felt he needed some gentle nudging. Very often the male of the species has a few elements missing, courtesy of Mother Nature, who seems to have given the vast majority of them, when it comes to that whole rearing thing, to the female.
If it had just... You've already said, I asked you, you know, I asked these men not to be faithful, but to be honest. If... Because in the end, there was a drugs issue, which is one of the reasons you ended it with my father. But if he had just continued to be unfaithful, do you think you would have actually stayed with him?
No, I don't think I would. I think I'd have got sick of it and I'd have found somebody else, probably.
Yeah, good. It never got to a stage with you then, which is kind of where I think it probably would with me if I were in your shoes, where it's like, well, if all these people are going to treat me like this anyway, I might as well get in there first and just take every opportunity I have to...
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Never kind of tempted?
No, it wasn't. It just wasn't in my nature. But I had been raised by a very, very strict father, particularly. And I was the eldest of four, so I was the little mother. So it just wasn't in my nature.
So you've been a mother from a very early age in one way or another.
And I think you know this, but even my own mother once said that she found me to be a bit of a prude.
Wow. Yeah, not many mums are telling their daughters that. I think most parents are hoping that that's the case a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know that my mother was quite wayward and my father was her sobering influence, which is why she put up with so much of his sort of nonsense, which was not infidelity, because her father was a serial shagger. You see, here we go.
Grandma's father.
Right. Yeah, he was a musician. Right. And
he was a jazz musician, wasn't he, or something?
No, he was a silent movie pianist.
Oh, silent movie, okay.
And so she was looking for stability. And because she had some of her father's genes and she'd been very wayward and she'd had to be packed off to her grandmother's at 14 because she was shinning. She knotted some sheets together to get out of her bedroom to go to the local TB sanatorium where there were lots of young men, patients, you know.
Good for her.
So she was, so she was a real handful. So she met my father, who I suspect that he was a virgin when they married. Mm. Yeah, I believe so. I can't know, because we never sat and had this kind of conversation.
No.
But I just suspect
shame,
that.
Because I think the way that you feel about your father isn't quite, I think it's shaded by the last couple of years when, you know, a grandma had died and he was very, very old and angry.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that actually you think he hates you or hated you. but I think he loved you very much, but you're just, you can't remember back past those last couple of years because he was so mean over those last couple of years.
I think I don't know.
If he'd only had a bloody podcast, then this could have been, you could have had this chat and it'd be recorded for eternity.
We could have done. The truth is that I'm sure that I could have sat down and had conversations with my mother, but I didn't want to. I wanted her to remain my mother. I didn't want to scratch beneath the surface. Right. Interesting. Whereas you do.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm 40. It's taken a while.
Well, yeah, but I was 60 when she died.
Sure. So. Yeah, I mean, and it's a generational thing. I think it's just become more apparent that people talking is way better than people not talking for everybody's mental health. And
I suspect my sister has probably had some conversations with my mother when she was alive.
Right.
Of which I was unaware, but I'm happy to remain unaware. Isn't that weird?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely your prerogative, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm going to bring us on to another very important moment in, well, very difficult, probably the most difficult moment of your life, but also something that I suspect, having known myself since my early 20s, has probably affected my life probably more than I even am aware. So I wonder if talking about it might help as well. And it's a topic that, I mentioned to you before we went on, that doesn't really get talked about. What is being talked about in public more a lot now is sexual abuse, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the narrative of sexual abuse a lot of the time when it's talked about is of it happening to young people, by which I mean, teenagers, obviously, or kids first and foremost, but then teenagers and people in their 20s and possibly 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But you were actually sexually assaulted when you were in your early 50s.
Mm.
And we talked about it you told me for the first time, I think, when I remember it being when I came back from university one weekend. I think you thought it was maybe a bit earlier, but...
No. I'm surprised it was that soon.
That's kind of how I remember it. And also, this was kind of at the very beginning of when date rape was being talked about, and Rohypnol specifically. And you were a victim of date rape, and I wanted us to talk about it and find out how you feel that has affected the rest of your life after that, in terms of in general, but also in terms of being able to have relationships and trust people, even if you I doubt you trusted any man before that, but it must be a fucking nightmare since then.
Okay, well, I think the term date rape is a misnomer.
Go on.
For a start, because...
Because you weren't on a date.
Well, exactly. Mm. Exactly. So I also have a feeling, and I said this to the policewoman that I had the conversation with sometime after it happened. I said, I feel somehow that the word rape is wrong, that rape suggests somebody was beaten around the head and dragged down an alley. But the date rape drug thing, as it's called, doesn't involve any violence at all, because the victim is utterly compliant.
Yeah. So you wrote, could you explain to us a little bit about you writing an article quite soon afterwards, anonymously, that then appeared in a newspaper.
Mm.
And then what I thought I'd do is just read the article out, because that'll explain what happened. And it was written at the time, which I think is also really important.
Yes, it was contemporaneous.
But talk us through, just quickly before I read it, how it came about that you thought that was a good thing for you to do and to make help with awareness.
Two things. One was that the few things that we were reading about at that time in the newspapers about these date rape drugs pertained to the USA.
Right.
That's why when it happened to me, I...
And what year was this? 1999?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find anything out. I wasn't on the internet. I didn't know what was going on, and I had to reach out to my sister and a friend who were on the internet to try and do some research. So the initial thing that I wrote was for them, as memory started coming back. And then I did eventually speak to the police, and then I thought, for God's sake, I'm now 52. This happened just before my... I think just before my 52nd birthday, something like that. And I thought, women of my age think that they're impervious. They're invulnerable. It's not going to happen to them because they don't go out on dates so much. This is before online dating,
sure.
Of course.
Yeah.
And I wanted to alert women of an age to the fact that they were also vulnerable. And so I phoned up a woman's editor, and I said, would you be interested in an anonymous article written by a woman, a middle-aged woman, who had been the victim of a date rape drug, and she bit my hand off. She didn't ask me who. She said, we've been looking for that very thing. Right. So, yes, I said, well, I'll get it emailed to you, and I emailed it to her. And they truncated it, of course, but it was published. And that was the reason I did that, was I wanted to alert older women who probably... And I'm glad I did, because, in fact, then online dating started to pick up and so on, and people in that position are...
I mean, also, I don't think back then a lot of younger women were really telling the full story.
Well, maybe not. I mean, it was very difficult. It was disappointing when because I didn't want to give my name to the police. You were 18 or 19 when this happened. And
18.
I didn't want you to have that on top of everything else. And you weren't in a great place at that time because you were fretting about what you were going to do with your life when you finished.
Still am.
Well, anyway, that was so she said, if you won't give us your name, you are an unreliable witness.
Right.
So, you know.
So, yeah. So at the time, you didn't want me to find out, basically.
Oh, no, right. I didn't. I did. And I didn't want your brother to find out, even. No. He was a bit older.
Okay, so I'm going to read this article. It's quite long. I will... but this is the full article that you wrote that they then edited to put in the Mirror. Okay. When a woman reaches 50, she tends to assume that she has either experienced or deliberately avoided experiencing just about everything possible. Certainly, she likes to think that she is aware of all the dangers associated with being female, particularly if she is single. Becoming single again in my 40s took some adjusting to. It had not been my choice, and for 3 or 4 years it was difficult to see anything other than the disadvantages of my situation. But gradually I began to almost enjoy it sometimes, eventually even learning to savour the pleasure of going to a function as a single person and meeting and enjoying conversations with people I might never have met had I been with a partner. I started to relish the fact that I now had complete freedom to choose where I went and what I did, that I was in control, and that was my big mistake. I had been invited to a big charity function at a rather splendid venue. The invitation came from the organiser of the event, and I realised that I would know no one there but him, and that he would be too busy organising to be able to spend any time with me. But hell, I could cope with that. I'd become rather good at it. And sure enough, as soon as I arrived at the champagne reception, I was invited to join a party of people who had noticed that I was alone and were only too happy to include me. I chatted with the husbands, I chatted with the wives, and even allowed myself a silent word of congratulation. I was doing well. When we were called into dinner, I found that I was sitting at a table with another mix of people, none of whom, of course, I knew, but they were equally charming. In fact, during the course of the evening, you could almost say that friendships were forged. Certainly one couple had given me their address and telephone number and invited me to visit them if I was ever in their area. I had a splendid time. I was careful to limit my intake of alcohol because I had been asked to play a part in some of the charity presentations. And so, aside from one glass of wine with dinner, I drank only mineral water. One of the husbands at my table danced with me, and I was relieved that I had straps sewn onto the bodice of my evening dress. Very safe, very respectable. Many of the guests had been given rooms at a nearby hotel, and we were taken back there on the coaches which had brought us. My new friends from the dinner table suggested we repair to the bar, which was filling up with others in evening dress, presumably guests from the same function. I did have a little more wine now, but still plenty of mineral water. It was late, but I was enjoying myself and felt far more alive than I would have done had I been drinking alcohol all evening. We sat around a large, low table and talked and laughed a great deal. The pleasure was marred only briefly by a belligerent drunk who approached me and made a rather offensive, sexist remark. I barely turned my head towards him as I demolished him with one of my damning one-liners and then returned again to the conversation. Occasionally, one of the husbands would announce that he was getting a round in, and so a glass of water or wine would arrive in front of me without my paying too much attention. I was vaguely aware that the belligerent drunk was behind me, leaning against the wall and talking to another, younger man, but I was enjoying the company and gave no thought to him. Unexpectedly, I started to feel a little strange. Light-headed, and even somewhat distant. I thought that maybe I had had enough wine, and anyway, it was very late by now and well past my bedtime. I stood up and announced to my companions at the table that I had had a wonderful evening, that it had been a pleasure to meet them, but it was really time that I went to my room. I floated to the lift, and as I pressed the button, a man entered the lift and the door closed. When it opened again, I stepped out, glided towards my room. I was feeling really good by now, about 4 inches off the ground, and took out the card to open the door. As I walked into the room, I was followed by a man, the man in the lift, the man I had noticed earlier leaning against the wall with the belligerent drunk. The door closed behind us, and I said nothing. I didn't demand to know what the hell he thought he was doing in my room. I didn't shout at him to get out. I didn't yell or scream. He pushed me back onto the bed. I watched him do it, as if from afar. He lifted up my long skirt, pulled down my tights and pants until they came off, still inside my shoes. I know that because that's how they were when I woke up. I watched as he raped me. There was no struggle, not even a token, no, I'm not that kind of girl, protest. I felt no fear at all, sensing rather that I was observing something of which I didn't altogether approve. I said to him quietly, "This is ridiculous. I don't even know your name." He was not violent, although he was, as they say in novels, urgent. His activities were curtailed by the sound of my telephone ringing, and I reached out a hand to answer it. To this day, I don't know for sure who it was, but I have since had my suspicions. Something about the sound of the phone seemed to bring him to his senses. As he stood and adjusted his clothing, I tried to sit up, but couldn't seem to comprehend the difference between ceiling and floor, and lurched forward helplessly. He reached out and caught me, sat me up on the edge of the bed, saying, "Don't fall off the bed now, will you?" and left the room. I awoke about 4 hours later, feeling like I had an axe lodged in the back of my head. I lay there for some time, trying to work out where I was and why, and then gradually it dawned on me. I had had sex. But who with? A stranger. Who? Why? What have you done? I kept saying to myself out loud. You don't do that. You've never done that. In 50 years, you've never even come close to doing that. I was shaking. I could see the tights and pants still inside the shoes on the floor, a grim reminder of my appalling behaviour. I was disgusted with myself. I got out of my clothes, into the bath, then dressed, packed and fled. I didn't even check out of the hotel. I was so ashamed. I think I shook for 2 days and nights. I was mortified and confused, not least of all because I could remember virtually nothing. How could I think so little of myself that I would have sex with a stranger? All I could remember of him was that he had dark hair and that he was considerably younger than me, perhaps around 30. Could that be it? Could I have been flattered by the interest of a man just because he was 20 years my junior, even though he was a total stranger? A week later, I awoke at 4 a.m. with the mother of all migraines. It lasted until midnight, during which time I was sick many times. The following day, I was completely exhausted and spent the whole day in my dressing gown. And then, during the ensuing week, tiny fragments of memory about that night began to come to me, as if from nowhere. They didn't necessarily make a great deal of sense, because they were so disjointed, but at least now I was beginning to remember something. The man in the lift, the belligerent drunk, although for the life of me I still to this day can't remember what he said to offend me, or what I said in reply. A few days later I was reading the newspaper and a word leapt out at me from the page. Rohypnol. I'd read about it before. Well, scanned articles about it before, really. Because at my age it didn't seem to have any relevance to my life, and I don't have daughters. And even as I saw the word this time, I didn't trouble to read the piece. And yet over the next day or two it seemed to haunt me. Could this, after all, have something to do with what had happened to me? Or was I seeking to justify what was simply an appalling error of judgment on my part? I had spoken of my experience with no one. The sense of shame was too overwhelming. But now I began to wonder if I should, now that I had the beginnings of a suspicion that perhaps my acquiescence might have been brought about by a drug. I confided in my sister and then in a close friend. I told them that I wanted to share with them everything that I could remember, because it was desperately important that I tell of my experience before researching the subject. I needed to know that I was telling the truth, and not just clutching at straws in order to assuage my guilt. One of them then accessed everything she could find about Rohypnol on the internet. She phoned me up. "You've got to read this," she said. "There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that this is what happened to you." So, thank you firstly for letting me read that out. How did, I mean, you dug this up again a few days ago because you knew we were doing this podcast.
I did.
How did you feel when you first read it back again?
Quite interesting.
And I guess also when you heard your son reading it out.
Well,
it might be interesting.
It is interesting. That was written in 2000. Or certainly it was saved on my computer in 2000.
Right.
So I managed to get it off an old hard drive. And I emailed it to you and to your brother, out of fairness. But interestingly, I didn't read it for a couple of days.
Right.
And it's not as if it's an issue for me. It really isn't. Mm. It's just that for some reason, I didn't want to address it yet. And then two or three nights ago, I thought, okay, I'll read that. And it was interesting to read it. It raises some questions for me that I won't bore you with.
Why do you think they'd be boring? I mean, I should say, just before you answer that, I have no recollection of ever having read that before the other day.
No, you wouldn't have done, because one of the reasons I thought I might never find it on the old hard drive was because I remember deliberately saving it with a name that wouldn't alert you, because you used to use my computer. Mm. And of course, back in the day, I didn't have the internet. So the reason that I went on the internet was to research this very issue.
Yeah.
Particularly because officially, it didn't seem to be in this country. Everything that appeared in newspapers about Rohypnol, or date rape drugs, as they called them, seemed to be happening in the USA.
Mm.
And not here. So I think I was, looking back, I think I was probably one of the early victims.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't researched that, actually, to find out when it first started appearing here.
Mm. And you talked a lot about it. The thing that really stands out, I mean, a lot, all of it, obviously, it's appalling, but the things that stand out to me are you talking about your own shame and how it links to your, I guess, your sense of self in terms of how you've been as a woman in terms of sex with people you don't know and relationships and that kind of stuff.
Well, think about this, Barney. If it had been a way of life for me, which it is for some people, and that's fine. No. I don't judge anybody. If it had been a way of life, then I would just assumed that that was another one.
Right.
Had I been a party girl, having fun wherever she could find it, which is absolutely fine, as I said, I would never have suspected. I mean, I'd have thought, bloody hell, I must have had too much to drink. I didn't think I'd drunk that much.
And presumably that's to suggest then that it might be, have been and still be far more prevalent than people even realise.
Well, I fear that could be the case. Mm. I fear it could. I think the thing that really made me feel so ashamed was the fact that I'd been so totally compliant. And just, you know, why did I not do the sort of thing that I would normally do, which is say, who the fuck are you? Get out of my room, you know, and scream and shout. And I didn't. I mean, it was just so out of character, just to be this, you know, whatever you say sort of person.
Right.
You know, just...
But a full out-of-body experience.
Yeah, it was. It was very much
an incapability of saying anything that you would normally say.
Yeah, but I wasn't scared. And I do remember when I reached over to answer the hotel phone, my arm was like a lead weight.
Right.
I didn't write it in there, but I do recall that very vividly. You know, I mean, we've all been drunk, but, you know, that doesn't happen.
Mm.
You know, and you can wake up with a hangover, but, you know, feeling like somebody's put an axe through the back of your head, no, that's... It's really severe, and I really had been very, very careful about what I'd had to drink that night, because I was on duty. I was actually
working.
You know, working.
And you mentioned before I read out the article that you then afterwards, once you'd kind of put two and two together, you then did speak to the police about it.
Eventually,
I guess it's worth telling us kind of what happened when you did that, and how you, and whether you felt it was worthwhile having done that.
No, I didn't. I didn't regret trying, but because
they took you to a safe house.
They did, in Wimbledon. I don't remember where, but I remember it was a safe house in Wimbledon. She was very nice, very clearly very experienced. with rape issues. And I do remember saying to her, you're going to think I'm mad, but I have a suspicion that there were two people involved here, that one was... My suspicion is that one probably supplied the wherewithal.
The belligerent drunk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other, who was younger and better looking, was supposed to get the ball rolling. And then when I was completely out...
He'd come in.
That would be what the phone was. I said to the police woman, you're going to think I'm mad. And she said, not at all. She said, you have no idea how many rapes take place in tandem. People don't seem to realise.
Right.
And I didn't know.
No, I've never been aware of that as a common thing.
It's what she said to me.
Yeah.
But because I wouldn't give my name, and you know, I've already explained why I wouldn't give my name, because I didn't want you or your brother to be traumatised by it. Not all my my parents too, to be fair. And my father never knew. I eventually told my mother, but my father never knew. I was an unreliable witness. All I wanted them to do was put a flag against their names, because by this stage I had ascertained who they were.
And how did you ascertain who they were?
Well, I knew who he was anyway. He was a snooker player. A bit of a celebrity.
A professional snooker player.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had, after a few weeks, I phoned up the guy, the old friend who had invited me and asked me to do this celebrity pulling, you know, the raffle tickets thing. And I didn't want to tell him what had happened. He was a huge bear of a man. Real Cockney. He was. He'd been in management. I suspect by then he was. He used to manage people in the music business. But I suspect by then he must have been managing people in sport. But I did know that he had been acquainted with some pretty dangerous people, and he was fond of me. You know, he was like a big brother to me. And if I'd told him what had happened, he'd have killed them.
Right.
You know, it was very, so I didn't dare. So I just phoned him up and I said...
Can I just ask then, so why did you feel any need to protect them when they just done what they'd done to you?
He's a good man. He could have... Well, he's dead now, but he was a good man.
He
could
have
ended up in
prison.
Jail, of course.
Right.
No. I mean, nothing it warrants that. So I just phoned him up after 2 or 3 weeks and said, look, I'm sorry I haven't phoned you, but I just wanted to say thank you for inviting me. What lovely people I met. And I said, who was the ugly drunk, some sort of sportsman? And he said, oh, and he told me he didn't want any horrible piece of work.
Right.
So I said, oh, that's right. And who was the younger guy he was with? And he told me.
Right.
And
that's the professional snooker player?
Yeah.
Right.
And then maybe a year or so later, a girlfriend of mine who is a keen snooker fan phoned me up and said, turn BBC Two on, he's on.
Right.
And I looked and there he was.
So that's where my question was going to be leading is, obviously in the last 10 years, 5 years especially, people have now come out and been, women have been brave enough to come out and tell of stories where they've been sexually abused or assaulted or abused in any way, and particularly that has kind of started from, or people, a lot of people say that they felt brave enough to be more honest about it because famous people have started to do it as well. So even in the last few weeks, Marilyn Manson has been outed by a number of his exes as a terrible sexual abuser. I can think of Shia LaBeouf recently, you know, along with many, many other examples. Why do you feel the need to protect somebody who treated you so appallingly? Is it because of you'd be afraid of retribution?
Well, let's be honest here. The guy would...
deny it.
No, he'd say, yeah, I had sex with her. She didn't say no. Mm. Well, she didn't say no. Let me tell you, I didn't say no.
Right.
The problem was that this is why I think rape is too strong a word. You know, I was utterly compliant.
But if you hadn't been given a drug, then you wouldn't.
How do we prove?
Then
this is the problem with that drug. It doesn't stay in the system long enough for you to realise.
Sure, but arguably, what you're doing is you're allowing a justification for it that to me isn't there, because it just would never have happened. It just wouldn't have happened otherwise. It's not like, you know, the old argument for these things, like, oh, she was drunk, she was gagging for it, she was begging for it, all of that stuff, which is what people have been, men particularly, have been saying for years about women in similar scenarios.
Absolutely.
But you know the difference. You've drunk alcohol. You know the difference between how you felt all the other times and how you felt that time.
He and I, this guy and I, had not had a conversation at all.
Right.
We'd not been introduced.
But what I'm saying is, it's clear, and I think it would be clear to any woman listening who'd had similar situation, that what you suspect happened is what happened. But it feels a bit like you're protecting the possibility that it didn't happen like that somehow.
No, it's...
And protecting him a little bit as well.
You've got to remember that the reason... Can we talk about Noel Clarke?
Because yes, good example, current. Yeah.
The reason that BAFTA gave him the award, even though they knew there were question marks against him, was because they had no evidence. There were rumours, there were anonymous complaints against him, but nobody had given their name. And the names weren't given until The Guardian was given the names, and then they published. And BAFTA say, had we known what was in the going to be in The Guardian, then he wouldn't have got the award. There were 20, I think there are more women. Now, that's different. The problem is, when there's one woman, this is why I wanted to put the flag against their names with the police, even as an unreliable witness, so that if there were other complaints, it would add veracity to...
Absolutely, and I totally understand that. But I don't think for a second that the police can be fucked to really check that stuff. And that's why the police have never done anything on Noel Clarke. So why don't you contact somebody in the press and say, look, just so you know, this is a name, these are two names, like historical stuff, especially with the darts player, I think, if we think he was really the person driving it, right?
Yeah, I suspect. So I have no proof.
In terms of historical abuse, you might be the first person to go forward, and as a result, 30 other women could come forward.
Possibly. Hadn't occurred to me, really. I think... I did... You know my doctor girlfriend. I remember telling her about what had happened, and she gave me some very sage advice at the time. She said, you weren't beaten around the head and dragged down an alley. You had all the tests. You didn't catch anything. You weren't a virgin of 16 years old who got
pregnant.
He didn't
make you pregnant, yeah.
None of that. Put it to one side. Let it go.
And that's what...
And that's what I've done.
But that's what women have been made to do all those years. Do you see what I mean? I totally understand. I don't think you should have done it any different at the time, necessarily.
Right.
But I'm just saying, these women who are now being honest about it are opening the possibility for women in generations' time to then not have to behave in the same way you had to behave, just because, you know, her saying, your doctor friend saying that, is just being like, she might as well have just said, oh, look, you didn't get killed, so just forget about it.
That's kind of what she was saying,
right?
Really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. But also, it's like...
But it helped me.
But also that
put
crime.
It
yes,
behind
fine.
Me.
But you know, and look, I'm probably just being too passionate because I'm your son, I guess, in this point, and I'm, you know, and it makes me angry.
You want retribution?
Well, it's crossed my mind over the years for sure. But it's not about retribution so much as just... I'm not even saying you should definitely do this, but what I'm suggesting is that it's interesting to me, I guess, that it's not crossed your mind, because you see all these kind of more modern examples of where people are now being brave enough to speak against people who have all the power and all the money. You know, if no one had spoken out about Jimmy Savile, it would have remained just the open secret that it was, you know, the hiding in plain sight.
I do agree with you.
Okay, so let me try and re-angle the question to a way where we can probably come to some kind of agreement or response, which is, if you read in The Guardian tomorrow morning that very famous professional darts player.
Oh.
Right? And that famous professional snooker player had been talked about by some brave women, you would absolutely...
Of course.
...get in touch.
Add to the list. No problem. And I gave their names to the police all those years ago. You know, and if they've got their record still, can you imagine that? But I did.
Thank you so much for talking about this on the podcast. I think it's all really fascinating, and I hope really will relate and be relevant to people listening. And Yeah, like I said before, I just think it's also, you know, not just because we're family and how difficult it was for us, but I think it is specifically that part we talked about in the second half is a topic that doesn't get discussed, really, which is the fact that rape can happen to anyone and it's not just a, you know.
Absolutely.
You should never, I guess what I mean is you should never assume that you're, like you did, you said in the article, you know, you assumed it wouldn't affect you.
Well, nobody's going to behave like that with me. I was more concerned with how I came across, you know, having straps sewn on the bodice of my dress, so that I didn't look like I was sort of putting out. Mm. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't need to put out because somebody would just take advantage of the fact that I was there on my own. I mean, that's basically the shock to me, which was, you know, it shouldn't happen to women of my age.
Honestly, it's been a really, I think, important conversation and also just a great start for this podcast, albeit slightly more serious than a lot of the kind of... all stuff to do with love and relationships is very serious, but slightly more serious than some of the more ghosting type stuff that we've got coming up.
But I was going to apologise to you for the fact that there were no laughs.
No. There were some laughs, but also, more importantly, just a very serious topic, I think. And guys, thank you so much for listening at home. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, either as yourself, or I'm more than happy for people to come on under a pseudonym if it would make you feel more comfortable, please email crazystupidlovepod@gmail.com. That's crazystupidlovepod@gmail.com. Also, use that email address to send in anything you'd like discussed on the show. Do give us a follow on Instagram @crazystupidlovepod, and please do press that subscribe button and rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye. I really hope you enjoyed that first episode of Crazy Stupid Love and found some of it relatable and relevant to your life in some way. As I said at the top of the podcast, I would love it if you'd subscribe to Crazy Stupid Love so you can get new episodes in your podcast inbox each week. The link to where to find the podcast is in the description box, or just type Crazy Stupid Love into the search wherever you listen to your podcast. So please, please do press that subscribe or follow button. And if you find yourself enjoying what you're hearing, feel free to leave a comment in Apple Podcasts too. Thanks again. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.